The subject assigned for this occasion reads, God's Providence in the Rise and Fall of Four World Empires. Perhaps all present will be conversant with those four world empires, but fewer in number, no doubt, will have given thought as to how that the providence of God prevailed in bringing forth those four world empires. Thou, O King, art the head of gold. The prophet Daniel addressed those very words to Nebuchadnezzar, the young and ambitious king of Babylon. God had chosen this heathen king to serve as a kind of catalyst for the good welfare of the Israelites and the heathens as well. What an unusual choice this was, and especially since the choice was made by our omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient God. The case is that God chose Nebuchadnezzar and the nation of Babylon to serve the spiritual welfare for Israel and, for that matter, for all mankind, including Nebuchadnezzar himself. Nebuchadnezzar was a man of high, lofty ideals. He held a high appreciation for the arts and sciences of his day. He aspired to be the most cultured, capable man of the whole earth. And aside from God's servants, such as Daniel, perhaps he was the most capable and cultured man of the earth. He endeavored to gather around him the brightest minds of all of the nations. If he could have known Solomon, he would have aspired to excel him. Nebuchadnezzar was a great builder. He elaborately decorated the temple of God, his god, Marduk. He made special and immense fortifications in the capital city of Babylon and of the king's palace as well. He became especially well known for his hanging gardens, which he built for Amytis, his Median wife, who longed for her native hill country. Nebuchadnezzar was a very religious man. When instructing Aspenaz, the master of the eunuchs, of how that he should take certain of the young men of the seed royal to Babylon, he also gave directions that part of the vessels of the house of God in Jerusalem should be taken and placed in the house of his god Marduk. Nebuchadnezzar could and at times did show humane consideration for others, as in the case of his appointing Zedekiah as king over Judah instead of some foreigner, but he was often cruel and ruthless, as when later he ordered Zedekiah's sons to be slain right before Zedekiah's eyes. Then Nebuchadnezzar put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was given to, and I quote, rage and fury, Daniel 3:13. Why would an impartial, just, and all-righteous God choose a king to rule over the nations, including his own people, the nation of Israel? Why choose such a king? The answer lies in the fact that God is absolutely just. and his justice is delicately balanced with his great mercy. Israel was not a chosen nation in the sense that God was partial to Israel, as we have all thought, I think. But God was interested in all nations. God held a vital concern for all nations, and he cast them off only when they refused to have God in their knowledge. Romans 1, 24 through 32. The patriarch Abraham proved to be a man of great faith, and on the basis of his faith and commitment to righteousness, God chose him to become a model of righteousness for all peoples to follow. Through a commitment to righteousness, Abraham and his descendants developed into a very unique nation, the nation of Israel. And that nation served as a light to the idolatrous heathen neighbors about. In time, however, Israel began to join the heathen nations in their idolatries. In turn, therefore, God sent prophets among them to deter them from their evil course. He did everything within his power to deter those Israelites from their idolatrous course. That is, his power predicated upon a predetermination and absolute provision for the free moral agency of man. Thus, from time to time, God gave his people the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. The time came when adversities and afflictions no longer deterred those Israelites from their idolatrous course. And then, as a last resort, so to speak, God determined for them the furnace of affliction. Isaiah 48 and 10. In time, Jeremiah wrote, "And the word of Jehovah came unto me the second time, saying, What seest thou? And I said, I see a boiling cauldron, and the face thereof is from the north. Then Jehovah said unto me, Out of the north, evil," that is punishment, "shall break forth upon all of the inhabitants of the land." Jeremiah 1, 13 and 14. In short, the cauldron which God chose was Babylon. The furnace of affliction, or the boiling cauldron, was the remaining remedy for God's people. And God chose the young king Nebuchadnezzar to administer that cauldron. The fact is, however, that God also instituted an ongoing preparation for Israel's restoration when the people had been completely cleansed of their idolatry. Even during the ministry of Isaiah, more than 100 years earlier than this time, God had caused the prophet to live, as it were, in the spirit some 150 years later, and to prophesy how that God would raise up his shepherd, Cyrus, even saying of Jerusalem, "She shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid." Isaiah 44, 24 through 28. Now, as emphasized at the outset, Daniel, when revealing and interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, declared, "Thou art this head of gold." Nebuchadnezzar had seen a great image with a head of fine gold, And Daniel's, "Thou art this head of gold," meant that the young king had been chosen to administer Babylon so as to make it a boiling cauldron for the Jews. And also, in a certain respect, to make it a cauldron for all peoples as well. Providence would prevail so as to boil the spirit of idolatry out of the nation of Judah, and at the same time to set up a spiritual influence for the disintegration of idolatry throughout Babylon, including the full conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was one whom God had especially abased. The great and fearful image which Nebuchadnezzar saw was a token of the overruling providence which would proceed from God for centuries to come. The great image which Nebuchadnezzar saw had a head of fine gold, breast and arms of silver, a belly and thighs of brass, and legs of iron and feet of iron and part of clay. The image represented the great world empires which God would raise up to make their respective contributions to the fullness of time. To illustrate, the head of fine gold represented the Babylonian Empire. The breast and arms of silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire. The belly of brass and thighs represented the Grecian Empire. And the legs of iron represented the Roman Empire. Through the means of divine providence, each empire would be raised up to make its distinct contribution to the fullness of time. That is, to make a combined contribution to the establishment of the kingdom of God. Paul wrote, "So we also, when we were children, were held in bondage under the rudiments of the world. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, that He might redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons." To be specific, the Babylonian Empire contributed the Jewish synagogue. The Babylonian army destroyed the Jewish temple, together with the city's walls and fortifications. Thus those Jews were scattered throughout all the peoples, and the synagogue order of worship grew out of those pathetic circumstances. All people were bound to take note of those Jews who in a quiet way met each Sabbath day to chant or to sing psalms, to read the Holy Scriptures, to pray to an only God, and to contribute of their earthly goods for the welfare of the poor. When the gospel was first preached on Pentecost, as per Acts the second chapter, there were present Jews, devout men, from every nation under heaven. And they continually worshiped God each Sabbath day in those synagogues throughout the nations. They surely made an impact on their neighbors and acquaintances. Thus, the synagogues became the stepping stones for the progress of the gospel. And further, Jesus met for worship and preached and sang God's praises in those very synagogues. The Medo-Persian Empire contributed a high value and respect for law and order. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, who was above the law, Darius the Mede, who received the kingdom, was unable to deliver even Daniel from the den of lions, as per Daniel the sixth chapter. There is really no way to overdraw the contribution of law and order in any society. And that goes for the United States of America. Thus, Providence continued to prevail. The Grecian Empire contributed a nigh universal language. In fact, Alexander the Great made some unique contributions to the fullness of time. To be specific, Alexander encouraged the emerging of society, both socially and commercially. He encouraged intermarriages with the Persians. He diffused Grecian culture, religion, and philosophy among the conquered peoples, and he so diffused the Greek language among the nations that it became a nigh-universal language. The fact of a nigh-universal language made for ease and fast communication of the gospel of Christ when it began to be preached. Thus, Alexander's contribution of the Greek language greatly facilitated the spreading of Christianity some 300 years later. Providence continued to be a prevailing force. The Roman Empire contributed all that had been contributed by the three prior empires, and further, that empire maintained an enforced peace, all roads lead to Rome, over the world, an enforced peace which the peoples of the earth had never seen before, nor have the peoples of the earth ever seen since. That enforced peace made for the rapid progress of the gospel. Rome's greatest contribution to the progress of the gospel was a cradle, so to speak, for the young church of the Lord, and that through the means of the high point and protection of its Roman citizens. The Apostle Paul, together with Barnabas and Titus and Luke, are classic cases in point. The providence was a prevailing force throughout those centuries of the world empires. The Jewish order of the synagogue worship made a distinct contribution to the kind or base for the New Testament order of worship, the worship in which we participate every Lord's Day. In fact, the very worship due a sovereign God. The case is that the divine order of congregational worship grew up and out of the established order of worship in the Jewish synagogue. And here again, the providence of God prevailed. As has already been observed, the Babylonians destroyed the Jews' beautiful temple and carried the people into captivity. Those mournful circumstances gave rise to the synagogue order of worship. Mournful and depressed, those Jews met in small groups. I thought about the lecture a moment ago. Met in small groups to pray. And in time, there came to be synagogues throughout the Greco-Roman world. Luke wrote, and I quote, "For Moses from generations of old hath in every city them that preach him, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day," Acts 15 and 21. When Jesus made his appearance, those synagogues were stepping stones for the progress of the gospel. The order of worship in those synagogues served as the pattern of worship for the Jews who accepted the gospel when it began to be preached by Peter and the other apostles on Pentecost. The Jews worshiped in those synagogues, that synagogue order of worship consisted of the following. those Jews met for worship each week. And that upon a certain day of the week, the Sabbath day. The items or acts of worship consisted of the oral readings from the Law of Moses, from the prophets, from the Psalms. It consisted of prayers and of the singing of psalms. There was no mechanical instrument of music in the synagogue as an accompaniment to their singing. And there was also a lesson of exhortation. One reading from Acts will serve to confirm the fact of the sermon or exhortation and other matters as well. The reading is as follows. Now Paul and his company set sail from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia. But they, passing through Perga, came to Antioch of Pisidia. And they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. And after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers or elders of the synagogue sent unto them, saying, Brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, stay on. Stay on. And Paul stood up and beckoning with the hand, proceeded to speak. That's from Acts, the 13th chapter. An offering or collection was made each Sabbath day for the poor and for the financial operation of the synagogue. Each synagogue had a ruler or elders, that is, men of age and experience, who directed the spiritual affairs of those who participated. The account of the supper reads as follows. Now when even was come, he was sitting at meat with 12 disciples, and as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and brake it and gave to his disciples and said, Take, eat, this is my body. And he took a cup and gave thanks and gave to them, saying, Drink ye all of it, for this is my blood of the covenant. The point I am emphasizing here, that the time came when our Savior introduced the Lord's Supper to the worship that had been going on for a period of years. Jesus preached in those synagogues. The relationship which he sustained to the synagogue and its order of worship had great bearing on the rise of the New Testament order of worship as it developed out of the synagogue worship. One very pertinent point is that Jesus visited and taught in the synagogues throughout Palestine and Galilee. John records how that Jesus answered the high priest, saying, I have spoken openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogues and in the temple, where all of the Jews come together, and in secret spake I nothing. Matthew recorded how that Jesus went about in all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, Matthew 4:23. In another place, Matthew wrote, and coming into his own country, Nazareth, he taught them in their synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished and said, Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? Mark records how that Jesus taught in the synagogue at Capernaum. And the reading is, And they go into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day, Jesus entered into the synagogue and taught, Mark 1:21. Luke also wrote of how that Jesus taught in the synagogues of Galilee. He said, And Jesus or wrote, he and Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and he taught in their synagogues. In another place, Luke wrote not only of how that Jesus taught in the synagogues, but he left on record also a sermon which Jesus preached in the synagogue at Nazareth. Jesus sang in those synagogues. This is another important fact. Jesus not only taught in the synagogues of Palestine and Galilee, but he also sang the praises of God in those synagogues. For one point of emphasis, who would dare contend that Jesus remained silent while the rest of the congregation sang the praises of the Father? For another point of emphasis, David prophesied concerning Jesus, "I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing thy praise." Jesus went from synagogue to synagogue, declaring the name of his Father. And in the midst of those congregations, Jesus joined them in their congregational praise to God. There is absolutely no indication that Jesus merely sang a solo in one of the respective congregations, as certain leaders of the Christian church are now contending, including Don Welt. The necessary inference is that Jesus joined with his brethren in their singing praises unto the Father. The author of the Hebrew epistle urged his Hebrew brethren, "Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works, not forsaking our own assembling together, as the custom of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day drawing nigh." Hebrews 10, 24 and 25. In keeping with this urgent plea, the Hebrew writer continued his urging. He wrote, "Through him," that is through Jesus, "then let us offer up a sacrifice of praise to God continually." That is, the fruit of lips which make confession to his name. The day upon which they met to partake was the first day of the week. Those meetings were regularly held on each first day of the week. And it was on the first day of the week that Jesus arose from the grave. It was on that day that he arose from the dead. What a day that resurrection day was. What a testimony the first day of the week bears to all mankind. What a day that first day is for the assembling of Christians. What a day the first day is for the multitudes to blend their lips in praise to God. But I wonder often if we're giving or failing to give the proper attention to the observance of the Lord's Supper. I was reared in the corner community. Back in the days when if we had monthly preaching, we had regular preaching. But we met every Lord's Day to partake of the Lord's Supper. And somehow or another, that has been ingrained in me. And if I let my mind wander, I rebuke myself. This is the day when I should have my mind centered on Christ and his resurrection from the dead. Up from the grave he arose. My, what a thought. And it's only in the resurrection of Christ that we have hope today. In conclusion, God's providence prevailed when He raised up prophets among His people to instruct them in righteousness and to warn them against sins of all sorts, and specifically against the fatal sin of idolatry. Then God's providence prevailed when He gave His people the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. And His providence further prevailed when He determined for those people the furnace of affliction, Babylon, the boiling cauldron. Further, God's providence prevailed when He chose the young king Nebuchadnezzar to tend that boiling cauldron. God's providence continued to prevail when He raised up in succession four world empires to the end that each empire might make its distinct contribution to the fullness of time. When and at which time He would set up a kingdom of His own, which would never be destroyed. Still further, God's providence continued to prevail when He provided that the pattern of worship for His kingdom in the church would develop normally through the order of the synagogue worship, thus necessitating only a change in the day for worship and the addition of the observance of the Lord's Supper by the saints. My brethren, when I reflect on these matters that I have hurriedly set forth, I'm really astounded. I ask myself, did all of this really take place? Did it really appear? And it did. And may God bless all of you.